Today we're going to finish the first book of Sefer HaChinuch, so that's going to be exciting. Not really a seum, because it's an artificial book. Division. So, but still, then you'll be able to leave your first book at home after this. So you'll have to, if you don't mind sharing a little bit, yeah. Okay, so this happens to be a very long mitzvah we're going to look at today. It's mitzvah 111, and it really ties in with mitzvah 26 and these six things, which I'll bring up when we get there. And then the final mitzvah. So I think let's do the final mitzvah first. 114, because that's pretty short. And that just takes away our thunder, sorry, for the finishing. But we'll finish first and then go back. So 114. So I really want to do this whole section on the Beis HaMikdash, but I also want to finish up this book. So today we're finishing up this book, and then next week we're going to go, we'll either start a section next week on the Kohanic garments or on sacrifices.
Are we having next week? Because before you said we weren't having next week. Yeah. Now we are having
I think
next
we
week.
Are, aren't we?
Well, don't
I
we owe you one? Originally said no.
Yeah, but don't I owe you one?
You do.
Right, so
you
that's next week.
Decide whether.
Oh, it should be next
be.
Week. Right.
Oh, we
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So we'll meet next week if you don't. I mean.
I actually double checked on my way here.
Will people
yeah,
be
yeah,
here?
That's the only reason. Yeah.
No, on the 20th.
Right. Right. I just have
oh,
to check.
Oh, yeah.
Also,
so I think
we
yes.
Are having
yes, this next week because I owe you a class.
Okay.
Right, so although we originally said this would be the last class, since I owe you a class, next week will be the last class for this semester.
Okay.
So we're starting with Mitzvah 114, the last one in Book 1, and that is that the court should not carry out any execution on the Sabbath. Now, it's interesting to think about this because we understand that on the Sabbath there's 39 major categories of work in which we may not participate. And those 39 categories of work have to do with the ways that the sanctuary was constructed. So one of the things that was necessary in order to construct the sanctuary was leather. You needed leather. And in order to get leather, you have to do what to an animal? You have to kill. Right, so no killing on Shabbos. Right, so you're not allowed to kill on Shabbos. So it seems obvious that you wouldn't be able to carry out an execution on the Sabbath. Except for executions, you're not supposed to keep people on death row and keep them in suspense and keep them terrified, but so you should do it right away, but not on the Sabbath. So it does not push the Sabbath aside. Now, there are some things that do. For instance, you're not supposed to draw blood on the Sabbath either, right? But we do circumcise on the Sabbath. If that's the eighth day, then we do that surgical procedure on the Sabbath. Even though, I mean, of course we do things that will save a life or a limb. So it's not just saving lives, by the way, just so you know, in case your finger gets caught in a door or something. It happened actually once to one of my kids where, you know, an upper part of the finger was at risk, but it's life or a limb. So you're allowed to ride to the hospital to take care of that piece of a limb.
What if it's another serious health condition, though, but maybe isn't life-threatening, but it's still
if you're a
neighbor,
you can.
Well, that's life-threatening.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's life-threatening. So it depends. I mean, there's all kinds of different rules. There's lots of different levels of sickness. There's a sick that's in the danger of life, sick not in the danger of life, and then lightly sick.
Well,
so those are all different levels, and then you can transgress different amounts depending on the level of sickness and how necessary the treatment is. So, for instance, let's say with a finger, right? Let's say you could just go like this the whole Shabbos. Let's say it was Shabbos afternoon at 4 o'clock and Shabbos is going out at 6. And you could just hold it like that for 2 hours. Hold it like that for 2 hours, if you know that. Let's say you don't know that,
right?
Then go to the hospital, you know, like, but let's say your next door neighbor is a surgeon and they say, oh, no problem.
Okay,
you could hold it,
right.
You know, yes, if it was Erev Shabbos, like if it was like just after candlelighting, you'd have to go to the hospital. You can't hold it like that for 26 hours, but you could for two, right? So if you know that, then you know that. But so it depends on how important the treatment is and how in danger the life or limb is. Anyway, that being said, we do push Shabbos aside for certain things, including, for instance, Bris Milah, but we don't for the death penalty. How do we know that? So it's interesting to look in here. He explains how we could know that. So in the second paragraph, we have the right to derive this matter from the verse, for you see, it is not needed for its own meaning, since it was already written elsewhere, don't do any work on it. Right, so here's the verse. Right, this is based on the verse, you shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations on the Sabbath day. From that, we know that you can't do a death penalty on Shabbos. You wouldn't think you could derive that, right? doesn't make any sense. So except, so what it's saying is, the reason why we can derive it from this, and so this is the reason why I wanted to show you with this inside, this is a very Gemara cup, very much, right? You know what a Gemara cup is? A cup is a head, right? From the word capital, head, cup, kepi, right? So, and a Gemara cup is a Gemara head, a legalistic head, but somebody who knows how to, like, figure things out from inside.
This is
totally a figuring something out from inside, absolutely. Right, so here's the verse. You shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations on the Sabbath day. Right, so he says we have the right to derive this matter that you can't do a capital punishment on the Sabbath from that verse. Why? Because we don't need that verse. Right, so we have a tradition that there's no extra words in the Torah. We already know you can't do anything that it took to build the temple on the Sabbath. Right, so why do you need that verse extra, that you can't kindle fire? Kindling fire is obviously something that you need in order to melt metal and in order to fix all the things that you need to do for the temple. You have to have fire. So kindling fire clearly is one of those things. So now, but we have an extra verse that singles that particular labor out and says you can't do it. So there must be something else that we learn from that verse. That's what it's saying. Right, so it couldn't be that we're just learning that you can't kindle fire on Shabbos. We know that already. So what are you adding to our information? So it's saying, what you're adding is, do not do any work on it. The fire is for the purpose of work. Hence, it's rather written to teach something separate. And so the sages explained about it, that it comes to teach us what we have stated, no death penalties. So it's also expressed in the Midrash Mechilta, you shall kindle no fire. Burning of fire was included among the labors forbidden on Sabbath, and it went out, it was singled out, in order to teach us an additional point of law. What is specifically characteristic about burning with fire? It is one of the forms of death imposed by the court, and it does not thrust aside the precept of the Sabbath to be carried out on that day. And so too, all other death sentences by the court do not thrust the Sabbath aside. So that's what we're saying. From the fact that this particular labor is singled out on Shabbos, so we know that because it's already included in the others, it must be coming to teach us something different. What is it coming to teach us? That you can't kindle the fire that kills that does the capital punishment. Now, we didn't burn, like burn at the stake. What is that fire? It's interesting because we do burn, but it's even worse than burning at the stake, I think. It's pouring hot lead down the throat. Or do you have to kindle a fire that makes the lead hot enough to pour it down somebody's throat? Yeah.
But isn't it interesting? Why wouldn't they have just said, I mean, if the sole purpose of this particular sentence was to teach us that we shouldn't put to death.
Why didn't they
just say that? I mean, you know,
it's an excellent question. It's an excellent question.
Well, what about death by stoning?
So what it's saying is, since we now learn, so that's two steps.
Yeah.
First, we learn that the reason why they say this separately is so that you should know you can't do capital punishment by fire, and you should know that any capital punishment is then included therein. So you're learning two things from the verse. One, that it means something different, so it's got to be capital punishment by fire. And if you can't do capital punishment by fire, then you can't do any capital punishment on Shabbos. So no capital punishment on Shabbos. So no stoning, no any of those things. So I think that's a fascinating thing. I mean, it's an excellent question. Why not just say it like it is? I don't know the answer to that question. But what I do want to say is this, because this is an important thing to think about. And it would be good. I should know the answer to that question. Why didn't I think of that before just to look that up? I didn't, but I should. But what's important to know is that things are not always as they seem in the Torah. And the reason why I'm pointing this out is because I just read in my daughter's college textbook, they're learning about religions and cults, and it's in a cultural anthropology class. And so it had pictures of Hamas terrorists and said, are these people terrorists? Is it really terrorism in the name of Islam? It can't really be, because if you look at, so that was their answer, no. They're not terrorists in the name of Islam. They're political fighters. Why? Because if you look at the Quran and if you look at the Bible, you will see a lot of violent texts in the Bible. So it couldn't be that Islam is more violent than other religions. And I'm thinking, what? What? What is the matter with you? Like, you have to be so politically correct that you have to print. Just omit it. Just don't print it. Like, just don't deal with it. Like, just like don't put the picture in and don't ask the question, because the answer is yes, it is more violent. And from a religious point of view, if you look in the text, it's more violent from a religious point of view. However, since I do have a child at this point who is constantly looking at YouTube videos about atheism and God and texts, and, you know, and he's regularly watching these ridiculous screeds of, like, how the Bible has violent passages, so I want to point out that you have to, A, look at the people to see how it's manifest. We're not a violent people, right? Throughout history, we're not a violent people. We've got a few problems right now with the state of Israel. But throughout history, basically, we're not a violent people, and we don't kill in the name of religion. We might be stupid individuals or wrong individuals, but there is no killing in the name of religion in Judaism, where there is in other religions. So in the name of the religion, not just for political gains, but in the name of the religion. So we don't have that. So if you run up against a text, so here's a text where you wouldn't think that's what it means, but you have to know from this that when you see texts that you would think that you know what it means, that's not always what it means.
Right? Yeshua kill a lot of people.
There were so I don't really know how to. I don't know enough to discuss the biblical times. There definitely was killing, for sure. No question about it. No question about it. There were lots of wars. So I'm not fully knowledgeable enough to discuss the biblical times, but you can definitely see that from temple times and until now, so for the last 2,500 years at least, we don't have killing in the name of religion. We did have the Hanukkah War. We certainly had wars where we defended ourselves, but we didn't have us going out to conquer, to make idol worshippers. Yep, so I'm talking from then till now. Yeshua maybe did, right? And there definitely were sometimes coming into the land where pieces of peoples had to be conquered. They were given choices to leave, first of all. So we didn't have... So, right, it is... Yeah, I do have to learn more about that to figure out how to explain that better. No question about it. But we don't have a world-conquering thing. We don't have an expansionist attitude as much as we're accused of that. We're not looking to expand. We're not looking into Jordan and Lebanon and Syria and Egypt saying, how can we get those of Dei Avodah Zarah, whether they are or whether they aren't, but how can we get those people under our banner and then get their land under our banner? That's not us. Yes, we had to go into our land, conquer our land, make our land suitable for our purpose. We have a specific purpose for our land. Excuse me, and having idol worshippers in our land doesn't work out for the Jewish purpose. So there did have to be some cleaning out. Nope. So there was an ethnic cleansing, in a way. There was. My understanding and my, sadly, my knowledge is weak. My understanding is that they were all given the opportunity to leave. So, and when you attack a city, you have to attack it only on three sides to give people an exit also. So we have that regularly. We do provide escape routes. We do warn. We do, you know, tell people to. It's not. So you might have to make the choice between life and land, right? So, and that's a difficult choice for a person to have to make. Yeah, for sure. The land is ours. Right. We had to conquer it. It does belong to us. So I could see how people who don't understand it as deeply, and I don't understand it enough, but would say, oh, we're the same. We also go and conquer land, kick people out, just like anybody else does.
Yeah, I can see why they might write the text like that, because if you look historically into early biblical times,
right.
So it could appear.
It could appear. You could,
if you didn't.
You could, from some biblical texts,
they don't.
Make some equations if you're not that knowledgeable or if you're not looking. Right. But if you look at the Jews and the history of the Jews for the last 2,500 years, and if you look at the history of other peoples, so we do not use our texts to go killing people or bring them under our control. Yes, we did have to conquer the land. That's true. And we did do some wars there. And we do have a concept of milchemet mitzvah, of a mitzvah war. We have that concept. The Rambam discusses it. So, but it's not the same. So I just want to point out here that you must always, always, always
so
look into the text.
The reverse. You're saying... Right. You're saying that
just like this,
because this teaches us that it isn't what it appears on its face, because there's another underlying thing. And the reverse of that is when something is very clear.
Looks like it's very clear.
We don't always know. We should also look and question.
Right.
And
so a classic example is where it says straight up in the text, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Right. So everybody's got their bumper stickers that say if we would do an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, we'd all be blind and toothless. Right. So
so obviously it couldn't mean that specifically.
It could mean that specifically.
It could, but we need to
question it. It could. But we Jews don't hold that it means that.
Yeah.
Right? If that text would be in the Quran, that's what it would mean.
Well, they do, don't they? With the cutting off
Yes,
the hand.
They do. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. You can't read our text like you can read their text. That's what I'm pointing out here.
If your left hand offends you, cut it off.
Right. Right. So, and we do have those kinds of texts. Right? There is a text in the Torah that says if two men are fighting and one of the men's wives, I forgot exactly how it says it, but this is straight up text. Gets in the way and embarrasses the other man. And it says she puts her hands on his private part, right? Then her hand is cut off. That's in the text. That's shot level. Her hand should be cut off. That is not what we do. That's not our thing.
That's not how we choose to.
We haven't taken the literal interpretation.
Impose that.
Right, but I'm saying but even though our text says that, that was never how the Jews did it. Never. Because our texts don't stand alone. They have a whole oral law that goes with them. So that's what's so important. So, if the Christians, if the atheists, if the Muslims are reading their texts and finding literal things, and then they apply that to our text, you could see how they might say, your text is violent too.
Right?
But you have to, first of all, look at the interplay of text and people, text and history, and also the interplay between text and oral explanation. So
that's why the oral Torah is so desperately important.
Right, right. You can't possibly understand the text without the oral. So here's an example of how you can't understand this pasuk without the oral law. You have to ask the question, why this pasuk? Why is it here? What does it teach us? It must be there to teach us something different. And so here we have a whole extra lesson that's taught from this pasuk that you would never know unless somebody taught you it. Right? Doesn't make any. I mean,
it seems like there have been a lot of examples that we have spoken about where something is a redundancy or whatever, and we go, "What is this?
Right.
Why?" And we find that there's some other reason why it was included according to the
right. So that's important just to realize is that you can never look at
the knowledge that other parts of the world know that there's oral Torah.
No. No, they don't all know that. Not at all. And that it was in the olden days when more people did know about it, it was rejected. It was part of, I mean, there have been arguments throughout history right up until today, basically, even among the Jews, about how much oral law we accept. So, I mean, that was a major argument in Reform Judaism. So when Reform Judaism first got started in the early 1800s, that was one of the key arguments. And it was even one of the key arguments in the conservative movement. The Reform movement said, we don't believe all this is God-given. We believe God exists, but, you know, we're going to rearrange everything, and we have the power to do that, and the oral law doesn't hold us back, and we don't even believe that the oral law actually applies. That was basically Reform, one nugget of Reform. Conservative was different. Conservative said, obviously there's an oral law. That's not a question. The question is, what is the oral law? Hi. Where does that oral law rest? What's the container of the oral law? So the Orthodox Jews say it's in the Talmud, and the way that we've explained it and worked on it throughout the centuries is the oral law. And conservatives said, no, the oral law was lost. But we do know that the oral law is in the mouths of the people. And so now we can convene a group of people and vote on what the oral law is. And that's what the conservatives did. So they created theological seminary, they have a panel on oral law where they have votes on what the law is and how it applies. So oral law and its applicability, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Has been a controversy throughout. I mean, Sadducees and Pharisees were arguing about that. And the Frankists and the Samaritans and there's lots of arguments. There's lots of pivotal groups throughout history that argued on oral law. So, but the Jews who are here today are the descendants of those who accept the oral law. even if they're a few generations removed, you can't go that many generations if you don't accept the oral law. You know, you can stick around for a couple of generations, but then Jews disappear after that, as Jews.
So. One quick closing thought that I had, tell me if my thinking's wrong, that when you think about Israel and the wars and everything, they were always confined to hold the land. We never went out to conquer new lands to bring people under.
Right, under, right, that's for sure.
Right, so I just wanted to say that in a real simple way, that we never were colonizing.
No.
Or conquering for the sake of Islam to save the world.
Correct.
Or anything like that. We stayed within the confines
right.
that Hashem listed for us to live within.
Right.
And that's what we defended.
Right, so it was to hold the land, but just to understand, it was to hold the land. Right, it never went outside the borders of the land of Israel. We weren't going chasing anybody anywhere. Right. So it was to hold the land. But it also might be, even when the land is secure, to cause people to not be idol worshippers. We're not allowed to tolerate idol worship
within the land.
Yeah. We don't have to go to India
right.
and kill those idol worshippers.
Right.
That's not our thing. And we don't have to bring them under the banner. That's correct. That's correct. It's only within our borders. So it's either to get a hold of the land or to keep the land the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
The purity of the land. Purity of the inhabitants of the land. It all has to do with within the borders of Eretz Israel. That's correct.
Yeah.
So there is no expansionism, there is no megalomania involved. We do, as I've mentioned before, have a plan to take over the world, but our plan is all by buy-in, 100% by buy-in. The Muslim plan is spiritual too, right? And the Christian plan is spiritual too, except for they manifest it physically. I mean, they bring you there physically. But our plan is by buy-in, our plan is by education. The more we spread education, the more people start to learn and see, the more people will want to bring themselves under, not our banner, under the wings of the Shekhinah. That's how it's, right? So it's not our job to go conquer people and bring them in. It's our job to educate and empower people so that they can use their divinely given free will to choose in. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're so rough on converts, you know, because you can't come unless you're really choosing it. And we want to make sure it's your choice. Right? It's not because it's cool, and it's not because the Jews are the winning team, and it's not because you're going to get married, and it's not because, you know, I mean...
They're so intelligent.
Right. It's not because you want to be part of a smart group of people, and it's not because you need the tzedakah or the chesed of the community. You know, in the Pale of Settlement in Russia, they closed conversions because people were converting for a potato, basically. They were converting for the tzedakah of the community. So people were starving, and if you were Jewish, people shared with you. So they just have to make sure you're not converting for any of that. You're converting because you get the mission of the Jews and you want to be part of that. So there's no way that you can force people in that. You know, it's not even just that it's practical. It is practical, but there's just no way you can force somebody to come to that. They have to do it on their own. It has to be 100% buy-in. So that's through education. So that's our plan. Educate, empower, and give people space to choose in. Okay, that being said, let's look at 111. The ban on eating or drinking anything from an offering to an idol.
Now that is, I just looked at that title and I'm like, what?
Right?
What are we doing with offerings to idols anyway?
Okay, so we're not supposed to be offering to idols, but other people do. Here we are in a land where people do, right?
But.
Okay, so we're not allowed to eat or drink anything offered up to an idol, for it is stated, take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they sacrifice to their gods, and they call you, and you will eat of their sacrifice. So, I don't think we killed all idol worshippers. There are only certain idol worshippers that we killed in the land. It's not just, and again, I'm weak on this, I don't know exactly, but I know clearly we did not kill them all. There were Jews who were idol worshippers, you know, but and there were non-Jews who were idol worshippers. So, and here's clearly discussing a non-Jew who's an idol worshiper and their relationship with us. So it's not like
clearly
you have to go kill
there,
them.
Right.
Clearly they're there. Clearly we're in relationship. Clearly we're living with them. Right? So here it's saying, so there's a general principle to not mix too much. And that's part of what kashrut is about. And that we're not supposed to imitate the ways of the non-Jews. You're not supposed to dress like non-Jews. You're not supposed to, that's part of not listening to non-Jewish music. So, and that's in different spaces in different people's lives and non-Jewish publications and movies and engaging in theater and all that kind of stuff. So the question is, how much are we mixing? How much do we put ourselves at risk for intermarriage, for intermingling of thoughts, for losing our direction as Jews? So there's lots of places throughout the Torah that discusses idol worship and intermingling. So here's one of them. So take heed to yourself. So just look at the words again. Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land. So an actual covenant, right? You might actually, this is not just chatting, but a covenant. And then they sacrifice to their gods, and they call you, and you will eat of their sacrifice. Let's say you're making a covenant, right? And the covenant includes a sacrifice. And they say, you know, you have a bite, I'll have a bite. We offered it to the God, we each have a bite, and now our covenant is sealed. Right? Now you might be eating.
But that seems like super obvious.
It seems super obvious.
That seems super obvious. I would say there has to be more to it.
So it's saying that is super obvious. Of course, you can't have a bite of the meat, right? But, so then it goes on to say, well, what if it's water? Right. Or what if it's salt? Like, those are nothing.
It is a naturally kosher.
A naturally kosher, but also completely insignificant. Water or salt.
This refers to idol worshippers, Gentiles. Well, what about the Jews among us who are not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In Green Gables Country Club, are famous for their shrimp and lobster buffets.
Right. Does that make them idol worshippers?
Well, according to this,
no,
they're not idol worshippers.
No, it does not.
Yeah, they're not idol worshippers.
No, it does not. The fact that a Jew transgresses and eats treif food does not make them into an idol worshipper.
An idol worshipper is something that was offered to a
human. Well, so there's a sacrifice
God.
That could be offered to a god. That's different, and that's an idol worshipper. But a Jew who just chooses to transgress is not an idol worshipper.
You could argue the point that our whole civilization today, and maybe Jews specifically and civilization in general, has really lost the whole essence of Judaism, and they are worshipping gods that are not God.
Yes and no.
I.e. sports, i.e. money.
So then the question is, how much are you worshiping that? So we use that metaphorically, but some people do actually probably worship it.
As opposed to just seek it or want it a lot or whatever.
Right. I mean, so, right.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a little bit more than that. I mean, like, sometimes we like sushi. I go to the, whatever the, I don't know what store that is that sells the nori, but it's an oriental store, right, on Federal. You walk into the store and there's Buddha right there with flowers and fruit and incense.
Offerings to it.
And I'm thinking, am I even allowed in this store? Like, but I know people shop there, but I don't, like, I'm so uncomfortable walking past that. It's like, I think, and even in the drain pipe outside, there's a little, like before you even walk in.
Really?
Yeah, they have like a little offering right there on the pipe.
But I've got even a more fundamental question than that. If you go back and you read this, it says, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the literal.
So, yeah, right. I'm looking just at what it's saying. Okay, so you make a covenant with the inhabitants, and they sacrifice to their gods. And they call you, and you will eat of their sacrifice. And then, as you pointed out, well, it's obvious that, you know, you wouldn't have anything major, but this goes on to say you wouldn't even have water or salt. But it seems to me, what are you doing even making that kind of a deal where
so this is going to go much more, forget the deal, this is going much more into, much further from that. So that's what I'm saying. We're so careful that it's, I was going to say it's ridiculous, but it's not ridiculous. We're so careful that it's really far-reaching, really far-reaching. So let's say it's a wealthy Buddhist family, and they have a whole cart of fruit in front of the Buddha, right? And now the fruit starts to get a little bit old. So they sell it in the market for compote, right? Mm-hmm. You can't buy that fruit. And if one of your friends bought it by mistake, you can't eat their kosher compote. It's completely usher.
Absolutely.
Completely usher, right? So let's just look here. Among the laws of the precept are, for example, what our sages of blessed memory said, that anything out of which an offering to an idol was made is thus forbidden, even water and salt. In other words, even though water and salt are minor, insignificant things, so that it's possible to say of them that they're not fit for an offering. Like, it's not something we would offer, right? So, and they were not set before the idol with the intention of honoring it all. They're nevertheless forbidden. Similarly, for the sake of keeping it so very distant, our sages of blessed memory, so here's the main thing for this particular thing, banned all wine of non-Jews, even if we do not know about it, that it was poured as a libation to an idol. So we know for sure, which the custom was, to pour a little bit of the wine as a libation to whatever god.
Before it was bottled.
Or sometimes people even do it. I've seen people, I mean, I saw one person, and I'm sure this is vestigial idol worship. Oh, religious, but Baal Tshuva, not that knowledgeable person. Every bottle of soda she opened, she poured a drop in the sink.
Really?
I was like, what are you, I asked her what she's doing. She said, well, that's where, like, evil spirits are, is on the top of the bottle. I'm like, okay. So.
Okay.
We can purify it that easily, huh?
Yeah, so that's great. So, and so that was a long time ago that I saw that in that person. It wasn't somebody that I could really confront at the time, but it was somebody who was clearly not knowledgeable. I still remember, like, talking to her. She told me one time that it's not her mincha to do something. And I'm thinking, minhag, not mincha. And she also told me she doesn't eat that shlita. I'm thinking, nobody eats rabbis. She doesn't eat that shchita, right? So she was definitely, like, working on coming into acculturation, but not there yet. So she was the one who was pouring off the top of the bottles. So it is a custom, whether when the bottle is opened or at the keg level, you know, when it's still in the, before it's bottled. There is a custom among idolaters and among, I think, even some Christians, and even I think in California some of them did that, pour off a little bit to whatever. So that's called yayin nesach, yayin, wine that's poured. Yayin is wine and nesach is poured. Yayin nesach is any wine from which a libation has been poured. That's completely usur. No question about it.
Libation.
Libation, a pouring, a ritual pouring. That's a libation, a ritual pouring. So any wine from which a ritual pouring has been made is completely off limits to a Jew. However, you never know. So it's not just that you never know. I mean, so here it's saying that in order to keep us that far, clearly that's forbidden. But here it's saying that stam yenam, which is general unknown wine, is also forbidden. So obviously anything that you've poured something from, but even wine that you don't know about is forbidden. So now the difference between the two is in the punishment that you'll get for consuming one or the other. So yayin nesach, there's no amount of it that's kosher at all whatsoever. So even if one drop goes into your regular wine or into your regular food, you can't eat it. It's completely forbidden. Like chametz on Pesach, right? It's that forbidden. Even a tiny, tiny bit. Whereas stam yenam, just plain old non-Jewish wine that you don't know from that something's been poured from, it just happens to be non-Jewish wine. So that, there's up to a certain amount. You can't drink it on purpose, but you're not punished until you drink a revi'it, which is like a, I don't know, a third of a cup that size. A small amount, but it's a real amount, like a cheekful.
As opposed to a drop.
And if you get a little bit of it, let's say it leaks or something, as you're passing it to somebody over your soup pot, and a little bit falls in, your soup would still be kosher, right? Something like that. So if it's just a little bit, if it's a small amount. So there is a difference halachically between the two, but this is coming to forbid all of it, to really distance you very far from anything. And look how long this mitzvah is, by the way.
Yeah,
right?
No kidding.
Right?
Right.
It's extremely long compared to the other mitzvahs that we learn here. And it's very long, and it's all about not having any kind of, not consuming at all, any type of product that is associated with idol worship at all. And it goes into wine in detail, about touching the wine. So we also have a halacha that wine that's touched by a non-Jew, if it's not cooked wine, becomes non-kosher.
That's where we get into mavushal and non-mavushal.
Right, so we have mavushal means cooked, and non-mavushal means non-cooked wine. If you look on your bottle of kosher wine, you will see it says mavushal or not mavushal on it. If it's not mavushal and you open it in the presence of non-Jews, you have to be very careful to pour it for them. It's so tricky. Let me tell you how tricky it is.
How about a Shabbos observant versus non-Shabbos
observant? So that's a whole different level, and it depends. Okay. It does matter. It does.
But I didn't know if mavushal would come into that.
It does.
Okay.
But I don't know exactly how far, like what that means in terms of levels of Sabbath observance and non-observance, But let's just say how strict it is, okay? So you opened your, for whatever reason, non-mavushal wines are considered better wines. They're the higher class type, but they're the risky type, right? You open your bottle and you pour it, right? So now you pour like four glasses in front of you and you hand it out. You have a non-Jew at the table. You hand it out. Everybody gets their glass. No problem. Once you hand that glass to the non-Jew and they take it from you, it's no longer kosher wine. They can drink it. No problem. It's no longer kosher. Now let's say they want seconds, right? And there's a drop of wine in the bottom of the glass, right, of non-kosher wine, right? Because it was their glass, they held it. Now what's in that glass, that drop that's left when you pour so many seconds, right, is not kosher. When you take that bottle and you pour it like this, and there's a stream that connects that drop into the, it goes back into the bottle.
That's like that little parasite in the Amazon River.
It does, though. That's how it works. So if you want to,
spiritual parasite.
It is a spiritual parasite. That's how careful we are with it. So if you
give them a new glass.
You give them a new glass. That's right. And they can't hold it when you pour it. If you, right. When you go to the when you go to the Jewish Experience Wine and Cheese, watch. They have only Shomer Shabbos wine pourers. Like whoever's pouring the wine is Shomer Shabbos, and they will take the glass. They take the glass, they pour it, and then they'll hand it to you. They won't. You can't pick up a glass, and they'll pour it into it. Because if you're a non-Jew, or depending on the level of not Shomer Shabbos, because there's levels there, and you're holding it and they're pouring it, it makes the whole bottle trace.
Huh.
So you can't.
The glass is on one side, other side of the table, or something.
They'll just take it from you and pour it. Or if it's got something in it, they'll just pick up a new glass for you.
Empty glass, they take it from you.
They'll hold it while they pour it and then hand it to you. Yeah. But that is the halacha. You have to be that careful with it. That's how careful we are.
Why, if it's an empty glass, can the non-Jew hold it?
No. They can't hold it while you're pouring it into it.
Why is that?
Because once they are holding the glass, they're touching the wine.
Because it makes the
whole. Even touching the bottle. Even touching the bottle. Even touching the bottle once it's open. Right? This is tricky stuff. If the bottle's closed and sealed, a double seal, so the cork's in and the thing's on, no problem. You can sell it, you can move it, you can ship it. You know, you can buy it from the non-kosher wine dealer, no problem. But once you open it, even if somebody picks up the bottle and moves it, it's no longer kosher. So.
Well, there have to be boundaries because people will always push that boundary. So at what point
right.
is it not kosher anymore?
So
these are the laws that have been set down.
Right, so that's what this is saying. So this is, I mean, that's what this whole long thing is talking about. And he gives a lot of details. Like if you look on page 415, now let this not be a difficulty for you. How can, and here he uses the word heathen, but in the Hebrew it's goy, a non-Jew, how can a heathen make an Israelite's wine forbidden? We have an established rule that a man cannot impose a ban on something that's not his. We can apply this rule only, for example, when someone prostrates himself to the domestic animal of his fellow, in which case he does no direct action with the object of itself. So that's interesting. Okay, so let's say you have a Hindu visiting, and they worship cows. You have a cow in the field, and they go out to pray in the field, and they prostrate themselves to your cow. Now what? Are you allowed to drink the milk from that cow or slaughter that cow? Right? So what it's saying here is, yes, you are. That they're prostrating themselves in worship to the domestic animal of his fellow didn't do anything to that object itself.
Did no direct action.
Right. He did that action, but didn't do anything to that animal.
Didn't touch it.
Right. So that animal still mutter to you, even though they did something usser, right? Mm-hmm. But so long as he does any action with the object itself, even a minimal action, like the matter of touching, he has the power to make something that is not his forbidden by the ruling of the sages. This ties into other halachas. If it's yours, if it's not yours, are you allowed? Can you affect something that you don't have possession over? Is part of the underlying question here. So it's saying, if you don't have possession over that cow, but you bow down to it, you don't trafe up that cow. But even if you don't have possession over the wine, but you actually come into contact with it and move it, the contact is what makes the difference here. So the sages are stringent in this matter, but not by the law of the Torah. Until he does some major action. So it's a minor action by the touching, but let's say he does a major action, like the Hindu guy goes out and he slaughters your cow. It's still your cow. You didn't sell it to him. He ritually slaughters. He's not going to slaughter it because he's a Hindu, but let's say it's somebody else, right? Whatever they are, that slaughters cows for ritual purposes. They go out and slaughter your cow. And you run out there and say, what are you doing slaughtering my cow? I was planning on using that for Shabbos. Give it back to me. Too bad. You can't have it anymore. Too late. They did affect your animal. Your animal is now an idol worship animal. You can't get benefit from it.
Well, it wouldn't be kosher any of those ways because he didn't kill it.
Let's say he was, whatever.
Saying
he,
even
you're
touching
right.
it, so.
No, not to the animal.
Oh.
But the slaughter. But I think you can't get any benefit from it. You can't eat it, but you can't sell it either.
Oh, you can't sell it
either. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Can't get benefit from
it. Is the rules about the wine, about the cooked and the, is that the same for Passover? Because that's the only time when I was reading something.
Yeah, same for Passover.
It's the same
rule,
because that's when I was reading about
that. Yeah, yeah, it's the same rule for year-round, whether it's the cooked and the not cooked and the Jew and the non-Jew and then the different levels of Shomer Shabbos and not Shomer Shabbos and how that all ties in together. Yeah, it's detailed. Judaism is fully detailed.
It's different from other wine.
No, it's not. It's only different that it that you're very clear that it has no chametz in it and was never in any vessel that ever had chametz. So, for instance, if you were in the same factory these days, or let's say there's a factory that produces, what is that stuff called? That's scotch and whatever those are made from, grains, right? So those are chametz, alcohols. But let's say it's a bottling plant that bottles chametz alcohols and then bottles kosher wine. That wine would still be kosher. It went through all those tubes and, and into the bottles and on the conveyor. It's still kosher wine, but it wouldn't be kosher LePesach.
Yeah, because it could conceivably
be not kosher LePesach.
I doubt it.
Yeah, Manischewitz, because...
Is not kosher LePesach?
Not all of it, because like we used to buy... It doesn't... Because some of it says kosher LePesach and some of it just says kosher.
Mm. Really?
Yeah, because...
Not LePesach.
Yeah,
I haven't seen wine that's not kosher LePesach.
Oh, yeah.
But,
like elderberry, we used to buy elderberry, but you can't buy kosher. Not elderberry, lowenberry. Whatever, there's some I know.
So that makes sense.
Because people will bring wine over it and it's kosher, but they don't know the look that it's kosher LePesach.
Uh-huh, that makes sense because some of those like wines that aren't necessarily wines, like an elderberry or loganberry, that's really a liqueur, could be produced in a factory that's not a wine factory that just has the Manischewitz label on it so that the sweeteners that are put in it might be a corn sweetener instead of sugar. That would probably be the problem.
That would probably be a big problem. In a wine that had a sweetener added.
Right. So that would be the problem in some of that. So those aren't wines, but those are alcoholic drinks. You probably can't make a Priya Geffen on it either, which means you can't use it for the four cups for Passover. So you have to...
Right,
I'm saying there are some things that would be kosher LePesach that aren't kosher. You'll see, especially on like some of the traditional things, or on Kedem grape juice even, it says kosher LePesach, and I think it just says it in Hebrew, kosher for the four cups for Kiddush and Havdalah.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you can use this product is enough the status of wine that you can use it for Kiddush, Havdalah, and the four cups for the Seder. But there are some other alcoholic drinks that are not appropriate for that. You can't use a kosher LePesach non-wine alcoholic drink for this for the four cups of the Seder.
Like a liqueur, for example.
Right. You can use it for Kiddush, but not for the four cups. So there's different rules in that, too. Okay. Back to this. So... So it's interesting. It talks about how stringent we are with wine all throughout this, and even the... even to a drop of it, and then it talks about vessels and how we're careful about vessels and vessels that held wines and even vessels that hold other things. Where is that? That's on page
17.
On page 419 on the bottom paragraph. It says, there too are the many details that were transmitted to us about a vessel used in their cooking. So it talks about vessels for non-Jewish cooking and vessels for Jewish cooking. And if they touched them, if they touched wine deliberately, non-deliberately, and all different laws all around this, he really goes into a lot of detail. But even it says that the vessels for cooking, which is a subject called cleansing of impure vessels of heathens. Further, we have the laws about keeping well away, not to make our souls abhorrent too, and the matters which follow in the wake of these vile matters. For instance, the teaching of the sages of blessed memory not to eat or drink from such loathsome vessels as urinals and chamber pots, and a surgeon's horn for collecting blood. So at first I was thinking, ew, right? Obviously, ew. But we're so wealthy today that we can easily think that.
Yeah. Right.
You know, of course we'd never think of having a dish like that do double duty. But
if you didn't have...
Right. I mean, I just watched the National Geographic or whatever it was, History Channel, something on the Dark Ages. It was such a miserable period in history, and that's basically when he's writing, just at the end of that, a little bit at the end of that, but just such a miserable time of such intense poverty and death everywhere. I mean, just constant wars and marauding and tribes and plagues and death and death and death. Mm. People were so desperately poor that you might use a chamber pot also to hold food if you were lucky enough to have enough food to go into a second vessel and you only had one for food. You know, so that's what this is coming to say. No, as Jews, we don't do that. You know, figure something else out. But you should just know that those things in the surgeon's horn, which is used for collecting blood, since the matter involves the abomination of the soul. So you can't do that. These and its further details are explained in the last chapters of the Talmud tractate Avodah Zarah, and some of them are in Chulin. So remember, he always points us in the direction of where else to go. And this is for every person at every time. Now, here's an interesting thing. On page 421. So I'll read these two paragraphs, because this is an interesting thing that you don't see often in the Chinuch. About this prohibition of wine libation, Rambam and Ramban, so that's Maimonides and Nachmanides of blessed memory, are both in accord that there is a negative precept regarding it, which is counted in the reckoning of the negative precepts. So we have positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs, and both Rambam and Ramban agree that this counts in the negative category. It counts as a mitzvah. However, they do differ on the subject. For Rambam of blessed memory derives the ban on wine of libation from the verse written in Sidrat Ha'azinu, as it is written, and drank the wine of their drink offering in Devarim 32:38. So they both agree that it's usur to drink, it's forbidden to drink libation wine. Mm-hmm. But they derive it from different verses, right? That's where they differ, the source. The ban on other offerings to idols he derives from the verse, let none of the banned devoted thing cleave to your hand. And from the verse, you shall not bring an abomination into your house and be accursed like it. So he derives other things. So wine from that verse, other things that were offered to idols from these two verses. On the other hand, Ramban of blessed memory wrote that from this verse, which is the verse in discussion right here, take heed to yourself, we learn the ban on all offerings in idolatry, including the wine of libation. So we have a machloket here, right? They both agree that the wine of libation is forbidden, but they derive it from different sources. Ramban derives it from our current source. Now here's what's unusual in the Chinuch, because the Chinuch writes according to the Rambam, Maimonides. This time he's going by the Ramban, and he says why. So I just thought that was interesting to see his process. Mm-hmm. Now I've written the precept of this verse in accord with his view, unlike my custom throughout the work. For all of them have I written according to the opinion of the Rambam of blessed memory. Here, though, I saw that it is most felicitous to derive and expound the subject from this verse. Moreover, it contains an admonition. So there is a lest, take heed or lest, right? That's an admonition. Don't do it. As the sages of blessed memory said, wherever in Scripture it is stated, take heed, lest, or do not, it is nothing other than a negative precept. But in the verse, the Rambam's verse, and drank the wine of their drink offering, there is no admonition. I have seen, too, that great authorities among those who reckon the precepts have written so.
He's following
the majority, but it's interesting that he usually follows the Rambam. In this case, he's disagreeing with the Rambam. He's paskening according to the Ramban, and he's writing it according to him. So that's an interesting thing.
He doesn't usually even point out.
Right. I mean, he does sometimes say what Ramban, sometimes it's a different count in the mitzvahs.
Right.
But here is really a principle of derivation and where they differ, and he is choosing not the regular choice for him.
Right.
This book basically goes by the Rambam. All right, so I just want to show you. Oh, gosh, we didn't get to this whole thing.
We didn't.
Okay, so I would just point out, and you can consider it. I'll let you come back with questions if you're thinking about it. So this 111 is tied into 26, to believe in no divinity but God. Number 26 is is one of the six constant mitzvahs. We did not look at the six constant mitzvahs as a group. So since we're not going to be bringing our book number one anymore for a while, just turn to page 55 in book number one, and you will see the list. It's the very end of the author's note in the beginning of, it's before his introduction. There's an author's note, and then there's the introduction to the whole book. At the end of the author's note, he lists, and this is where the concept of six constant mitzvahs comes from.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so the Aish.com has all kinds of stuff on the six constant mitzvahs. There's books written on it. But this is the source of the six constant mitzvahs. It's right here in the Sefer HaChinuch. So he says there are six. There are all the mitzvahs. Let me just read that paragraph. All the mitzvahs have different times when they apply. They don't apply constantly, but only for certain times of the year or the day. The following six precepts, though, are an exception. Their obligation is constant. It is not interrupted or removed from a person for even one moment in all his days. And these are the six. To believe in the eternal Lord, not to believe in any other deity, and from that all the avodah zarah things come from, to have faith that he is one, to love him, to fear / revere him, not to go astray following after the thoughts of the heart or the sight of the eyes. And it's interesting, his mnemonic, because this mnemonic only works if you're pretty learned, the mnemonic for him, for this is, there shall be for you six cities of refuge. So, if you know about the Levites and the cities of refuge, and that there were six of them, and actually there were more than six, but in a certain place there's only six. So if you know all that, then that will help you remember that there's six constant mitzvahs. Otherwise, just remember, six constant mitzvahs, and these are the ones. So I just wanted to, we were going to look at them a little bit, but as a group, and maybe we'll do that another time, but look at the group of the six constant mitzvahs. That pays to study it as a group. But you should know that this 111 is definitely tied into 26. So 111, to the ban on food and drink from an offering to an idol. And the reason why I spend so much time in it is because of the importance of really keeping it out of your life altogether. Now, that being said, even though I started late, so I'm going to make you stay just an extra minute late. So at the Maisel Museum right now, I just did Taste of Limud Colorado yesterday. And right now, they haven't yet opened it, but they have an exhibit, 4,000 Years of Gathering the Sparks. I think it's going to open in February. And it's a really beautiful installation. It would be nice to go see it. One of the things that they have in the exhibit, which I didn't get to see, but I heard about, so it would be interesting to see, and I looked it up online today because I was not happy with something I heard yesterday. They have a whole example, and apparently it's the only whole example of it in North America, an incantation bowl from the year 400 from Babylon. Mm-hmm. And it's Jewish. Wow. So I was thinking, what's a Jewish incantation bowl? That bothered me. And so it has Aramaic and Hebrew writing in a circle inside it, and the whole thing. And the last three words are shalom, shalom, shalom. And now there's a question about how that incantation bowl is used. So one theory is that by putting water in it and swishing it around, when you drink that water, the words of the prayers go into the water and into you and heal you. That's one thought. And the other thought is, because many of them were found, and this is what I saw online, excuse me, many of them are found upside down. This bowl was found upside down. Many were placed upside down in corners of houses to trap demons. And so particularly Lilith. No. So somebody in the room didn't know who Lilith was and looked at the curator, Lilith. Mm-hmm. And the curator said, the feminine energy. And everybody said, oh, obviously the Jews want to trap the feminine energy. It bothered me so much that was just like such a clear understanding of what Jews would do in their patriarchal society. Of course, they'd want to trap the feminine energy, and that's what Lilith is, and blah, blah, blah. And not understanding the whole thing in the Reformed Judaism and how they've made Lilith into this whole heroine, and it's not supported by the sages, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, incantation bowls are part of Avodah Zarah, and that would be Jewish Avodah Zarah. Yeah. So Jews, as we've moved through different societies,
idol worship.
So it's not idol worship. Avodah Zarah, service or worship. Avodah Zarah, strange. Zar is a stranger, right? So Avodah Zarah. So a worship that is not Jewish. So anything that has to do with, I can't say anything, because there are some Kabbalistic things too. So it's really hard to tease it apart. That's the problem.
So that isn't good, the bowl, then, is
it? No.
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 It is not something that is...
This is not Jewish. It's just something that Jews used.
It was a custom in some
groups
at some time
right.
who were Jewish.
Right.
And it wasn't an idol.
But does Lilith have anything to do with it?
Forget Lilith. That was a parenthetical thing.
But
forget that. Well, it does. But forget that.
Lilith and the whole
whole idea that she was a demon, that she would steal baby souls, and you know that she
was a Bubba Meister.
For sure it's a Bubba Meister, but there is a concept of Lilith. What is that concept? I think when I go to Israel, I'm going to learn a little bit more. I'm going to set up some learning time for myself at the end of January. I think I'm not sure exactly when I'm going, but I am sure that I'm going to try to set up some time with some Talmidot Chachamot and explore a few different subjects. I think that might be one of them, because it does come up kind of regularly. What is that? I would like to see it a little bit more inside. She's only mentioned three times in the entire Talmud. There's Midrashic references. I don't know them all, but I do believe that in much more modern literature, she's been made into more of something. I think my understanding is that in the ancient understanding, she was a female demon. So just because you mention a female demon, does that mean that all feminine energy is bad? I don't think so. You know, I mean, I was thinking about as I was driving, you know, like a woman could be bad, and it doesn't mean you're misogynistic to point that out, right? And a demon could be feminine and could be bad, and it's not misogynistic to try to get rid of them if you're in the context of demon getting rid of. You want to get rid of the men and the women demons, right? They're both bad. So I don't think that's particularly misogynistic to point out.
Identify
that as a female and get rid of it.
But does Judaism believe in demons? We don't believe
in demons. Yeah, we do. The Rambam doesn't appreciate it and doesn't necessarily believe in it, but a lot of other sages do. So, and the question is, what is that? It's a whole different discussion. We could go into that a little bit.
Well, when we studied Lazzato, I mean, the evil forces. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And, you know. So there's definitely a concept of negative forces, no question about it. And we do learn, I mean, it's important for us to know that the whole physical world is a parable for the spiritual world. It's not the opposite. So the physical world is like a shadow of the spiritual world, except for our understanding of shadows, that shadow is so much lighter and thinner than our heavy bodies. But it's the opposite, really. The spiritual world, which is lighter and thinner, casts a shadow in the physical world. So any physical thing that you see has its roots in the spiritual world, which means that you can learn about the spiritual world by learning about the physical world. So for instance, with that is, there is a Kabbalistic concept that there's so many demons around that if you could see them, you would be too petrified to function. That's how many there are everywhere, right? So what does that mean? But today, with electron microscopes, you can see all the creepy crawlies that are all over your skin and all over everything. You know, there's bugs everywhere, there's germs everywhere, there's bacteria everywhere. If you could see it, you could never eat. Would you ever be able to pick up a piece of candy and stick it in your mouth knowing that there's hundreds of bugs that you just put in your mouth and they're crawling all over, right? We wouldn't be able to function if we saw that. But the little ones are. So when I do that and I just licked 100 bugs off my skin, they're 100% kosher. You can't see them. All these bugs are all kosher, all of them. Because if you can't see it, not if you didn't look for it. A fly in a fold of lettuce that you didn't see is treif. You can see the fly. You just didn't see the fly. But the other bugs on that leaf of lettuce that you can't see
with the naked eye,
with a naked corrected eye, not a microscope, but a naked corrected eye, a regular plain old eye, right? Those bugs are kosher. They are kosher. Yeah. So anyway... So we could, there is a parallel between what's there physically that we don't see and what's there spiritually that we don't see and the harm that they could do to us. And now that we understand all those bacteria and germs can harm us. So that's there too. And how do we protect ourselves from that? And then we have to understand also that there's a way to protect ourselves from them spiritually as well. So that's all. Whole other long discussion, but it's definitely there.
So we are having class next week.
We are having class next week.
And then when is it starting again in January? Because we had left that up in the air.
Right. What day of the week is the first? The Saturday?
The second is a Sunday.
The second is a Sunday. So do you want to start on the third? Will people be here?
Of January. I'll be going to Israel January 16th.
Yeah, I might be going to Israel January 16th also. That's what I'm wondering, if I should or not. I didn't decide. That's why I would sort of rather start earlier, so that if I do, it's not like one class and then a break.
The fourth is okay. Are we talking about the fourth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Does the fourth work for a lot? The third.
Class.
The third.
Okay, that's fine.
Monday after, does that work for people?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, just for you it doesn't. Okay, so your kids are still off of school. No, you don't have kids off of school then?
I do.
Oh, you have your babies off of school because it goes to...
Well, we're going to be in California.
Oh, you'll be in California.
All right, okay. So we are starting... So we do have class next week, and then we are starting on the 3rd.
So...
Right. I'll send you the tape.
Okay.
Cross-pollination of plants.